Welcome to Twice Blessed, a Yeshiva University Strauss Center podcast exploring Torah and Western thought. I'm your host, Shayna Trepido, and this season we're examining Shakespeare and the Hebrew Bible. It's an honor to welcome Professor Paul Cantor as my guest today. He is the Clifton Waller Berry Professor of English at the University of Virginia and has been contributing to, or rather shaping, Shakespeare scholarship for over 40 years. His earliest publications illuminate the influence of ancient Rome on Shakespeare's early modern plays, and Professor Cantor's engaging lectures on Shakespeare and politics, covering 17 plays, I believe, are available online for your enrichment through the Great Thinkers Project. While a prolific Shakespearean scholar, Professor Cantor's interests range far and wide. If you visit his faculty page on the University of Virginia's website, be prepared to scroll through an extensive list of publications that explore everything from classics of Western canon to The Walking Dead. In this conversation, I will be taking advantage of Professor Cantor's pop culture expertise as we discuss Shakespeare's Henry V and the Hebrew Bible. Arguably, it was Shakespeare who got English history trending on the Renaissance stage at a time when the Bible itself was popular culture, saturating nearly every aspect of early modern life. Professor Cantor, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So Shakespeare's history plays, presenting the lives of English monarchs, including King John and Richard II, Richard III, Henry IV, VI, VIII, really, the vast majority of the plays that present English kings open with English kings on the throne. And if the king isn't present in that opening scene, then people close to the king, his kinsmen, his courtiers, are there discussing palace politics. But right away, the audience, groundlings and all, are meant to feel as if we have instant, immediate access to royalty. Henry V, though, is a bit different. Shakespeare makes us wait for it. Instead, the play opens with this conversation between two clergymen, the Bishop of Ely and the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they're discussing this proposed bill threatening church revenue.
For all the temporal lands which men devout have given to the church what they strip from us, and to the coffers of the king besides, £1,000 by the year, thus runs the bill.
This would drink deep.
To drink the cup and all.
Doth his majesty incline to it or no?
He seems indifferent.
This conversation goes on for the first 100 lines of the play, and it seems like a very strange place to start for a drama that, as the chorus promises, will present kingdom, princes, monarchs, and the warlike Harry. So before getting into the more specific instances of the Old Testament's appearance and influence on the play itself, what are your thoughts on this scene and its significance? What might Shakespeare be suggesting, perhaps, about the relationship between politics and religion?
Well, it shows Shakespeare highlighting religion as a central issue of politics. I kind of fell out of my chair the first time I read this scene because it's so extraordinary. Not so much for its simple presentation of a bishop and archbishop, but the way it presents them. They sound like Exxon lobbyists getting ready to deal with Congress. And indeed, that's Shakespeare's point. It's actually a fundamental point throughout the history plays, but in some ways it culminates here, that one of the key questions of England's history and the foundation of what for Shakespeare was the modern English idea of kinship was how to deal with the problem of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church looked very different in Henry V's day than it does now. It was infinitely more powerful. And in the case of England, it owned huge amounts of land, had a tremendous amount of revenue, arguably was richer than the king himself, and it had an allegiance to what to England looked like a foreign power, namely the papacy, which was then a political unit and far larger than the mere Vatican now. And so one of the issues that Shakespeare's kings have to come to deal with is how to deal with the Catholic Church. And Shakespeare shows here in this opening scene what was to be Henry VIII's final resolution of the Catholic problem in England, namely taking the country Protestant, but in some ways more importantly, seizing all the church's land. and especially the very wealthy monasteries, and moreover using that land to create a whole new set of aristocrats who would be directly loyal to Henry VIII, and not to the and not like his other aristocrats feeling independent from him. Now, Henry V does not do that, but he's on the verge of doing it. It's exactly what the bishop and the archbishop were worried about. That's the first thing they focus on, is the loss of the land, and they mention it could support a whole number of knights and so on. And so by threatening the Catholic Church with what we might call the nuclear option today, Henry gets them to back off and give him what he wants, namely a religious justification to go to war with France, because he would very much like a holy war. He would like to gain a new legitimacy for his regime by appearing to lead the country with God's support against the French. So it's a really brilliant scene, in the sense that it introduces us immediately to what Shakespeare saw as a key element to the policy of the English kings, which the Tudor monarchs, beginning with Henry VII and culminating with Henry VIII, had brought to fruition, namely to create a national church in England, the Church of England.
Well, thank you for that rich context that sets us up to notice the play's investment in, to use your words, gaining legitimacy through religious justification, or at least the appearance of God's support in war. It's really seen throughout Shakespeare's history play of an early English monarch written for his Elizabethan Tudor audience. And your reading of this opening scene beautifully sets up the following one, Act 1, Scene 2, in which the Archbishop, at great length, lays out the basis for Henry's right to the French throne. And ultimately, Henry presses the cleric for just a direct yes or no.
May I, with right and conscience, make this claim?
The sin upon my head, dread sovereign. For in the Book of Numbers is it writ, when the man dies, let the inheritance descend unto the daughter.
As Nasib Shaheen and other careful readers of Shakespeare in the Bible have noted, the archbishop's assurance of the sin upon my head echoes a phrase that appears throughout Tanakh, or the Hebrew Bible, in Joshua and Samuel, Kings, Esther, the Psalms, just to name a few. For instance, in the book of Joshua, in return for Rahab or Rahab's assistance, the spies sent by Joshua promise that her family will be spared when Jericho is taken, but warns that if anyone ventures outside the doors of her house, Damo Berosho, his blood will be on his head. But, they continue, if a hand is laid on anyone who remains in the house, Damo Beroshenu, his blood shall be on our head. And it's so interesting to me that when Henry spies, so to speak, on his own soldiers the night before the Battle of Agincourt later in the play, an iteration of this phrase comes up again.
Every subject's duty is the king's, but every subject's soul is his own. Therefore, should every soldier in the wars do as every sick man in his bed, wash every mote out of his conscience, and dying so, death is to him advantage. Or not dying, the time was blessedly lost wherein such preparation was gained. And in him that escapes, it were not sin to think that making God so free an offer, but he let him outlive that day to see his greatness, and to teach others how they should prepare.
'Tis certain, every man that dies ill, be ill upon his own head, and the king is not to answer it.
I may be overreading these reverberations here, but what do you make of this Old Testament trope that takes up the responsibility or accountability of leaders, soldiers, and individuals in times of war and conquest, and perhaps more broadly, this early Israelite narrative that seems to be invoked in Shakespeare's history play?
Well, I don't think you're overreading it at all. And in fact, some very astute commentators on Henry V have shown how the whole Book of Joshua was very much in the background. That, for example, Joshua's besieging cities and the policy he uses to do that very much is paralleled by Henry V. In fact, one critic has pointed out that if you go to Deuteronomy and see God's instructions for siege, Henry V follows them to every point, and especially quite honestly, the cruelty of the sieges and saying, what do you do when a city resists you see, namely, kill everyone. And Henry avoids that by making that threat against the city, French city of Harfleur, scaring them into surrender. So in general, so much of what goes on in this play is sketched out in the Book of Joshua, including, as you say, the issue of spying. Spying is so crucial to the Book of Joshua and this whole incident with Rahab. And Henry is a master at spying. He spied on his nobles and uncovered a plot against him. He spies on his own troops the night before the battle to see what their morale is and so on. So I think more generally, we can view this in the context of Henry VIII's creation of the Church of England. That is, I think Shakespeare recognized that the Hebrew Bible offers an example of a national church in modern terms. That is, you had a community that is united under one God, and that God leads them into battle. It's very interesting that the one time that Henry V addresses God directly, he addresses him as God of battles, which is very similar to the biblical Lord of hosts, and is not the most preferred Christian way of addressing God.
O God of battles, steal my soldiers' hearts. Possess them not with fear. Take from them now the sense of reckoning of the opposed numbers. Pluck their hearts from them. Not today, O Lord. O not today. Think not upon the fault my father made encompassing the crown. I Richard's body have interred new, and on it have bestowed more contrite tears than from it issued forced drops of blood.
It's very interesting indeed in that scene in Act 4 where Henry's essentially asking for forgiveness for his father's murder of Richard II, that he never mentions Jesus, who is the part of the Godhead you would ask for forgiveness in Christian terms. He addresses the God of battles, and I think that is very significant that we're seeing in this play is the notion of a God who fundamentally manifests himself in the victories of that nation over its enemies. And I think Shakespeare sensed a problem with a Christian God as a God of battles, given all this emphasis on peace and forgiveness in Christianity. There's this wonderful Irishman in Henry V, McMorris, who at one point says, "I would have blown up the town, Christ save me." And it's such a contradiction. He's this violent, aggressive man, and yet he's swearing by Christ that he would have blown up the town. And that's one of the greatest lines in Shakespeare. Only Shakespeare could have written that line. And I've never seen anyone notice the oddness of it. But it is, Shakespeare made the point, we are lucky that some of our soldiers have a Christianity that runs only skin deep. That if they were profoundly Christian, they wouldn't be blowing up towns. That you need a certain kind of hypocrisy to be a valiant soldier in a Christian regime. So in some ways, I think Shakespeare is looking for cover under the Hebrew Bible, that this is something that has authority with Christians and yet presents a very different view of battle and in fact has a God of battles.
I agree that Henry offering a prayer, as it were, to the God of battles strikes us as odd here, especially from a figure in the play who the chorus tells us is a mirror for Christian kings. But to me, it seems more pagan, maybe, or maybe more like an online gaming trend, like God of battles, right? Then it seems Jewish. Just because it's such a strange translation, if what Henry or Shakespeare is trying to do is invoke the Hebrew Bible and link this Henry to early Israelite leaders. So Stephen Marks, in his book Shakespeare and the Bible, explores the influences of Moses and Joshua and David in Henry V, and he considers this divine epithet, God of Battles, as a derivative or translation of the Hebrew Adonai Tzvaot, or Hashem Tzvaot, which Shakespeare would have seen translated in the English Bibles available in his time as Lord of Hosts, with this archaic kind of military, you know, word for army or legions. Now, there are, you know, various names for God in the Hebrew Bible and extensive commentary, really far beyond me and really kind of off topic for us, about how each name encapsulates a different attribute of the divine essence. One name invokes God's wisdom and compassion or justice. But I do think it is worth noting at this point that the name Hashem Tzevaos, or Lord of Hosts, doesn't actually appear at all in the first five books of Moses, which I guess is contrary to some popular belief. It's much more prevalent in the later prophets. And the word Tzeva or Tzevaos in the Torah, when it does come up, it can be understood as troops, legions, but also it can be used to mean tasks, masses, and even multitudes. And as one of the names of God to appear in the Hebrew Bible, it's discussed in the Talmud. It has its own Jewish exegetical tradition. It even features surprisingly prominently in Hasidic philosophy. But some commentators have said that this name, Hashem Tzevaot, God of multitudes, really rather than God of battles, is supposed to underscore God's omnipotence, that God, commander of all creation from heaven to earth. So if Shakespeare is following the cultural political trend of his time that was linking the early English experience with the Israelites, who were transitioning from an enslaved people emancipated by God to a nation of God who was with them in battles, then I see how he got here.
And so indeed, the notion of the God and the nation going together, that's what Henry brings about in this play. And this business of sin upon my head, it's very characteristic of Henry that he's always trying to transfer the sin off his head to somebody else's. He's very clever in that way. In this first act, he gets the archbishop to take the blame for the war on France. He gives the go-ahead and moreover says, basically, if it goes wrong, blame me. That's very convenient for Henry. Later in the second act, when he discovers that the nobles are plotting against him, he gets them first to say, well, he asks, what should I do with traitors? And they say, kill him. You got to kill him. And then he says, by the way, you're traitors, I'm going to have you executed. And they're stuck. They basically endorse their own capital sentence. And similarly, he has this long struggle with the soldiers. Some of them want to say that if they die in an unjust war, it's Henry's fault. And he goes through all sorts of sophistic reasoning to reverse that on them. And of course, with the town of Harfleur, he says, you got this choice. If you surrender, you're okay. If you don't surrender, I'll kill all of you. It's your fault if you get killed. I'm giving you your out here. So I think Shakespeare sees this as a just a psychological point. It's an enormous burden for a king to carry. Is the sin on my head or on your head? It's very fundamental to Henry in the play.
So that's very interesting, since thematically, the Book of Joshua shows us a series of moral dilemmas for leadership. And in each episode, it reinforces that military success is first collective, but it also is not about might. It's about faithfulness to God's covenant. But if Henry insists that he's not responsible for the lives that might be lost on the battlefield, can he then just turn around and claim responsibility in the event of a victory?
It's a twofold strategy, really. He wants to gain credit for the battle, but not claim it. And I think he knows he's going to get credit for this battle. I mean, he's the king. He led the troops into battle over everybody's objections, and he won. And no one's going to take that away from him. And there are many kings who I think Shakespeare feels foolishly would want to seize the credit and make the most of it. Henry instead insists that this was God's victory. And indeed, he refuses to take credit for the battle. He says in Act 4, Scene 8, O God, thy arm was here. Which again, that's a quote from the Psalms. Let's see, that would be Psalm 44. And not to us, but to thy arm alone ascribe we all. When without stratagem, but in plain shock and even play of battle, was ever known so great little loss on one part or another? Take it, God, for it is none but thine. And then Exeter says, 'Tis wonderful. And it's just what Henry wants, the idea that his victory was a miracle, because that means that God stands behind him. And he's had this terrible problem since his father, Henry IV, killed the anointed king, Richard II, that he stripped the religious aura, the sacred character from the English kingship. And he's trying to get it back here. I'm a miracle king. God stands behind me. And amazingly, he says, without strategy. Now, anybody who knows the Battle of Agincourt knows it depended on one of the great stratagems in world military history, this notion of using essentially a phalanx of archers to mow down the French cavalry. It's what won the battle. It's never even mentioned in the play. The numbers were miraculous. The French had thousands of dead and the English had maybe 25 dead. The reason that's so is it was one of those moments, as in World War I, for example, the first time machine guns were used en masse against charging soldiers. That's why there was so much carnage in World War I. And here, again, it's absolutely an example of military technology winning the battle. But Henry doesn't want to explain it that way. He wants God's assurance that God stood behind him. And it's perfect for his purposes because everybody knows he won the battle. No one's going to deny it. He showed this already in Henry IV plays when he killed Hotspur in this great showdown. And he let Falstaff take the credit. Again, everybody was going to know that Prince Hal killed Hotspur, and he was going to get the credit. But he seemed so magnanimous by appearing not to claim credit. And here he then leads to a request for some songs to be sung, and they're Non Nobis and Te Deum. And Non Nobis is, let's see, that is from Psalm 115. And it's not unto us. It's describing God intervening to save the Israelites when they left Egypt. It's a very famous psalm, and it's in fact part of the Passover service. And so this is Henry's Passover here, and it is the idea that, you know, we will give credit to God for this victory over the French, just as the Hebrews gave credit to God for their victory over Pharaoh and the Egyptian chariots. In the famous St. Crispin's speech, Henry sets up his own Passover service. He basically says, we're going to win this battle, and then we're going to celebrate, and we're going to have a feast, and we're going to talk about it, and you'll teach your sons about it.
Old men forget. Yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered.
It's quite amazing. It's like Shakespeare had been to a Seder here. But it's very significant. It's weird that he transfers the blame to other people, but here he transfers the credit to other people, namely God. But it's all part of his larger strategy in this play, of getting a holy aura. His father had proposed a crusade. He thought that was the only way to establish his position as a revered king in England, and he never got to the Holy Land. In an irony, he died in a room in his castle named Jerusalem. But he told his son, that's what we need, and Henry came up with this idea, the crusade will be against France, and we'll get the church to bless it, we'll attribute the victory to God, and then I will be the holy anointed king of England. And it's really a brilliant strategy, and I think Shakespeare understands it, and it's Henry starting on the route to a church of England. which again is what emerges if you go to the Henry VI plays and Richard III, they end with the first Tudor monarch, Henry VII. And this whole process starts, in effect, with Richard II, historically, when it's like it's the end of the Middle Ages, the last of the holy Plantagenet kings is killed, and then it plunges England to chaos, and Henry V almost gets England out of that chaos, except he dies young, and his son comes to the throne too early, and so it takes another cycle before Henry VII emerges. But I think Shakespeare understands what the English monarchs have to do is get some of the prestige of Hebrew kingship for their rule.
All of this is so fascinating, and I'm especially charmed by the idea of a Shakespearean satyr. I agree 100% that some of the lines in Henry's rousing speech to his troops before this epic battle have kind of Exodus overtones. In fact, if we look at the Holinshed source that Shakespeare uses for his plays, and which scholars agree Shakespeare clearly read and follows so closely that parts of his play might be considered verse paraphrase of the Chronicle, the lines that don't appear in the account of Henry V's speech from October 25th, 1415, are the lines that you call our attention to, that sound almost lifted from Exodus, and that appear in the Passover service, such as Exodus 13:14, which says, "And when, in time to come, your child asks you, saying, what does this mean? You shall say to him, it was with an almighty hand that the Lord brought us out of Egypt." Shakespeare seems to borrow perhaps this temporal structure of projecting the past into the future as a means to ensure legacy, heritage, and perhaps continuity. In his commentary on this portion of Exodus, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of Blessed Memory considers the rhetorical potential of this moment when Moses is addressing the Israelites for the first time after they've been freed from 2 centuries of exile, slavery, and oppression. And he notes that Moses had a few thematic options for this momentous occasion. He could have gone the Abraham Lincoln Gettysburg Address route and focused on the value of freedom. He could have pivoted to this new bliss in the land of milk and honey that awaited them, or he could have offered a warning. These are the dangers and challenges that lie ahead. But instead, Moses, Joshua's mentor, speaks about the importance of educating the next generation, which underscores the message that the real challenge, as Rabbi Sacks phrases it, does not lie in gaining freedom, it lies in sustaining it, keeping the spirit of liberty alive in the hearts of successive generations. And this, for Rabbi Sacks, fits with one of the unique features of Judaism, that its greatest heroes are not conquerors or strategists, but rebbeim, educators and teachers. So perhaps on that note, I wonder if you might share with us one final thought about what makes Shakespeare so enduring. The history of the English monarchy might not be my history or yours, but as readers, we return to it over and over again. So what brings us back to Shakespeare? What does he have to offer us as a dramatist and maybe as a teacher?
Well, I think we can see it just in the sense that it's not only Jews that learn from the Bible. Shakespeare has given us a kind of Bible. In some ways, as we've seen, it's rooted in the Hebrew Bible, but in some ways I think it's quite different. But in any case, he has the same ability that the Bible has, namely to tell human stories that have incredible emotional power, incredible dramatic power, stories that, you know, like Abraham and Isaac, or the story of David, or these are archetypal stories, but they also have deep meaning. It's not just that they're soap operas where we get exciting stories of sex and violence, although we do get that in the Hebrew Bible and we do get it in Shakespeare. But they have such meaning and can teach us so much that's why they live on. And in particular, in light of what we said today, I mean, they have such political meaning. Now, again, I'm not claiming that Shakespeare was Jewish, and I admit he never went to a Seder, and yet he found great meaning in the Hebrew Bible. I think it's true for Machiavelli as well. Machiavelli was fascinated by the story of Moses and ranked him up there with the great founders like Cyrus and Romulus. Machiavelli found a kind of Machiavellian meaning in the story of Moses, who, after all, took this enslaved people out into a desert for 40 years till everyone who had been born a slave was dead, because he wanted to form a new free people. And he did not think that people who had experienced slavery could be free. And the whole experience in the desert was to shape them up into a people who could maintain their independence, and that meant become an army, because they had a lot of conquest to do. And I think Shakespeare invokes Moses in the background of Henry V, because he's feeling the same way about Henry V and the English people in general. So I think, I mean, there's so many lessons in these works, and they're often somewhat hard to figure out. You got to read the plays carefully, and that in itself is Shakespeare training us to be his own readers and to learn things in the very process of reading. So in that sense, I'm not surprised that these plays continue to fascinate people, and whatever people try to do to diminish the importance of Shakespeare always failed. Shakespeare survived every attempt to neutralize him, and I'm afraid there's a lot of attempts on the part of my colleagues to strip Shakespeare of his power, but they're up against a force much greater than they are.
Thank you so much. This has been unbelievably enlightening, and the reading, this emphasis on coming back and reading and again, and the power that that yields is so important for us and for our listeners, and we thank you so much for your time.
Well, you know, it's interesting that in many ways the best impulses of Shakespeare critics are Talmudic. They are learning to read a text, to consider arguments about the text, to come back and forth on the meaning of a text. I don't think it's an accident that many of the great Shakespeare scholars have been Jewish. In that sense, there is, I think, a very interesting connection between studying Shakespeare and studying the Bible. In a way, what we've learned to do is study Shakespeare with the care with which we learned to study the Bible. And I like to think in that sense I was brought up to read Shakespeare. It didn't hurt that my mother had the same birthday as Shakespeare, April 23rd.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I 100% agree with all of the care of reading and what that gives us as capacity and as a strength. Thank you so much for your time. This has been wonderful. We hope that you'll come back and visit with us again.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you for listening to Twice Blessed, a project of the Yeshiva University Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. This show is produced by Uri Westrich and Sam Gelman. Information about this episode, including the audio credits and reading recommendations, is available in the show notes. If this conversation left you feeling blessed, please subscribe to Twice Blessed on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and consider leaving a positive review, sharing it with friends, and following us on social media. Thanks for listening.